celebrating 100 years of history of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota in sound. This is a presentation of the NFB of Minnesota History Committee with audio recordings gathered by Tim Awney and Steve Jacobson. Your narrators are Ryan Strunk and Jennifer Dunham. Music is copyrighted by the National Federation of the Blind and used by permission. Part 1.
In 1920, when the NFB of Minnesota was established as the Minnesota State Organization of the Blind, the world was very different. Here is Frank Hall, who later attended the founding meeting of the National Federation of the Blind, describing his feelings when he graduated from high school.
I left Faribault June 1st, 1908. Took my grip and didn't know what would thereafter become of me. I began working in the as a piano tuner for the Board of Education of Minneapolis in January 1909.
One of the major driving forces that led to the founding of our organization was the difficulty of blind persons to find housing. Maxine Schrader, a member since 1941 who passed away earlier this year, describes the situation.
The people needed it in those days because no one wanted to rent to a blind person. It was really tough. It's hard to think about that now, you know, but that's how it was then.
A home and industrial center for the blind was established, but members continued being active in the community. Andy Verdon, a member since 1951, remembers when he first began riding the bus.
We figured out that I've been riding buses since 1934, so maybe 75 years of my life I've ridden buses.
At about the same time, Maxine Schrader visited the home as an 8-year-old child to read Christmas stories to some of the older residents.
When I was 8 years old, they wanted me to read a Christmas story, and so my mother went out there with me. And when we came into the home, I heard this clock chiming. And I said to my mom, "Mom, what is that? What is that?" And she said, "That's a clock, and I want to see it," I said. So it was in the dining room at the home, and I went to see it, and I loved it so much, and I've got it today in my apartment. Because when they sold the home, they had this auction. I bid $50 on the clock, and I got it. And this clock was from 1890, so it's a real antique, you know. And I've been offered $3,000 for the clock. And, of course, I didn't take it because I love that clock so much.
Many problems confronted blind people of that time. By the end of the 1930s, an interest emerged to start a national organization. Joe DeBeer and Frank Hall were two Minnesotans who were very involved, as Joe DeBeer describes.
We got to have a national organization. And they got together and finally decided between California and between Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania already had a committee what had been in Washington. So Pennsylvania won. Mm-hmm. That where the first meeting was to be. And then Chick Tenbrook, who's a lawyer in Chicago, I think, at that time, and he became the first president. And I didn't go to the first meeting. I couldn't go because my boy had polio, and I stayed home. I took care of him. Frank Hall was the, and he wouldn't go alone, so I sent my wife at Frank Hall. And then the message I sent was, coming together is the beginning. Working together is progress. Staying together is success. And a year later, 1941, Dr. Newell Perry, he was there. He said, "Joe, we got to have a board." So we got a board together. I can't remember how many members, but it was a small organization from the start. But it kept on growing all the time. The second year was bigger than the first, and that's the way it developed. Now we got over 55,000 members.
Both the United Blind and the Minnesota State Organization of the Blind joined the National Federation of the Blind. And for the next 37 years, Minnesota was the only state to have two affiliates. Andy Verdon describes the role of the state and national organizations when he became a member in 1951.
It was a different time in the early 50s when I joined the organization in 51. I had been sent down for training at the Minneapolis Society for the Blind, but the blind people wouldn't talk about the Minnesota Organization of Blind. They would say that organization. And then they didn't talk when I joined about Federation. They were just the Minnesota Organization of Blind. Two guys would go to some national conference to a legislative meeting, two or three people, once a year at a convention, and that's all I knew. But then all at once, this Braille magazine came called Braille Monitor. I got interested in it. It was really challenging.
In 1953, Maxine met Dr. Jacobus Tenbroek for the first time.
I met him after after the banquet speech. He was up by the stage with a young Kenneth Jernigan, and they were surrounded by people joking and having fun. He was a fun-loving person, too, Tenbroek was, Dr. Tenbroek. For somebody with his super intellect, he had a wonderful gift of talking with people from all walks of life. And, you know, rich or poor, young or old or whatever. And made the people feel so good about that and so glad and so included. He was a warm, wonderful person with people. I just can't tell you how good that was, and he had such a wonderful sense of humor.
In 1960, the Minnesota Organization of Blind, dropping state from the name in 1954, celebrated our 40th anniversary at the annual state convention. Dr. Tenbroek was in attendance and made several comments. He was followed by C. Stanley Potter, Director of State Services for the Blind, and Francis Brennan, who gave a state legislative report.
Last year, another blind person came to see me who had been to the Rehabilitation Bureau with a story that he wanted to be a lawyer. The Rehabilitation Bureau analyzed him, examined him up and down, looked at his record, talked to people who knew about him, and said that he didn't have either the intellectual competence or the personality to be a lawyer. They refused to give him any assistance. My assessment of him was that the Rehabilitation Bureau was right, that he probably couldn't be a lawyer. But here's the critical point. It's not my job to order this fellow's life, to tell him what I thought he could do. If there is anything important in all creation, more than any other, it is that a man ought to select his own destiny so far as the circumstances of society permit him. I acted on this theory, raised some money for him. He studied, got his background training, went to law school. Last year, he was number one man in the first year class. If you're going to carry on employment therapeutically, then I would say that the present shelter shops are one of the poorest places in the world to do it. That probably the same thing goes for rehabilitation and the training in the shelter shops. Probably the worst place in the world to train a man for competitive industry. And this is so because the setup is such, machinery is such, and the atmosphere is such that that's not where you can provide the training they need. If you're going to have them as places of employment, then the blind people who work in them ought to have all of the guarantees and protections extended to labor anywhere.
And I'm not in favor of operating any kind of a shelter facility unless it pays the minimum wage and unless employees have the rights that employees do in regular industry. This seems to me to be a fundamental human right.
I was talking to some of the older members. They tell us that proposition has been brought up as early as the early 20s by this organization. It was definitely brought up on our convention about 45 or 46 here, but it was rejected on the idea that the education department is not qualified to handle boarding schools. But now since they've opened up a school for handicapped children at Worthington, that is no longer an argument. The agencies shall consult with the elected and proper representatives of the organizations of the blind on their policies.
Because Minnesota had two affiliates, The United Blind and the Minnesota Organization of Blind had to alternate which organization would actually cast votes at the national convention. In 1961, Clifford Troll of the United Blind answers the roll call for Minnesota.
Minnesota?
From Minnesota, we have Ben Isnes, president of the Minnesota Organization of Blind, and his wife Edna. We have Andy Rood. Andy Rood, president of the United Blind of Minnesota, and his son Harold. We have Clarence Johnson, Jim Schleppergrill, Skyler Kenny, and Mr. and Mrs. Skyler Kenny, Jack and Lorraine Arvidson, Francis Brennan, Vincent Hillman is supposed to be here, and I'm Clifford Troll. I'm here, and my mother is here. Don Hunter from Minnesota, and his secretary, Miss Lucille Prairie, and I will be on the nominating committee. Mr. and Mrs. Ingwald Gunderson came in. I didn't know about that. I hope I have them all now.
Okay, thank you, Cliff. The president of the NFB, the first vice president, the Washington representative, attended variously the Western Conference of NFB affiliates and conventions of our affiliates or their executive committees in Washington, Oregon, Minnesota, and Iowa.
The Minnesota Organization of Blind continued reaching out to new members, illustrated by its president speaking at the commencement exercises at the Minnesota Braille and Sight Saving School.
And now, a word about our speaker. He is one of our most distinguished graduates, having received his diploma in 1917. Currently, he is the president of the Minnesota Organization of the Blind. I consider it an honor to introduce so distinguished an alumnus and colleague. I present Torger L. Leon.
Graduates, you have picked yourselves an excellent motto. I shall either find a way or make one. Now you can do one of two things with this motto. You can frame it and hang it up and use it to remember the day of your graduation by, or you can make it a part of yourselves and live by it.
While operating the Home for the Blind was still a major part of the efforts of the MOB, connections with the NFB remained active. Here, Andy and Maxine describe meeting Dr. Tenbrook.
I'd like to say how I became acquainted with Dr. Tenbrook. I met him in person, and that we really got to know each other in 1965. Tenbrook thought he would come and interview and see what could be done. What's going on in Minnesota? And the agency treated us as dirt, and especially the vendors. They had a little association. And the MOB would give them a room at the old Home for the Blind at 1605 Eustace Street to meet in. Mr. Jim Ryan, who's with the United Blind, and I were to meet the Dr. Tenbrook at the door on this Sunday morning. He came about 11 o'clock. We had several major grievances with the agency and with a particular vending stand problem of Lou Tyson, who had been a major in service and lost his sight in World War II. And he didn't think he should have to pay commission to the post office department. They were treating the blind very roughly, playing one against the other. The results of that meeting were that he would get the commission from the vending machines in the post office building.
I was a delegate from Minnesota, and I had a couple questions I wanted to ask him about the way I was going to vote. So he invited us up to his suite, and Susie was with me, my daughter, and her friend. We went in there, and of course, right away, he was so good with kids.
and he mixed them some root beer and gave them some snacks and stuff. And I thought, hey, when am I going to ask my questions? He talked with them about their schools and all that stuff. And, they, of course, they loved him. He always remembered their names then after that.
As the 1960s closed, a frustration with the role of consumers in the rehabilitation process emerged. At the same time, many agencies that provided services to blind people became involved in the establishment of the National Accreditation Council for Agencies Serving the Blind, NAC. This, together with the National Convention held in Minneapolis in 1970, resulted in the formation of a student division here. In addition, movement to get some meaningful representation on NAC and in one of its leading proponents, the Minneapolis Society for the Blind, gained strength. Here is Joyce Hoffa at an early student division meeting describing one of the first protests at the Minneapolis Society for the Blind.
Unfortunately, the weather wasn't with us that day. It rained torrentially. We arrived at 10:30 and stood under an awning for a long, long time, out of the rain, until somebody went out of the back door of the society, drove around the block, came to the front door, and rolled up the awning. There we were out in the rain.
In an effort to reach out and better understand the Minneapolis Society for the Blind, their executive director, Frank Johnson, appeared at a student division meeting in 1971. Longtime active member Ingvald Gunderson raised a question.
We have a committee on organizational structure. This committee is reviewing our articles and bylaws and taking a look at streamlining some of the provisions which have been in effect for a number of years. We feel, just like I think you do, that there should be some criteria, in other words, something specific to qualify a person as a member. So we are developing that.
Do you honestly believe that there are blind people that would like to work to improve the society that would not work in the best interest of the benefit for blind people?
I certainly understand and know some persons that have publicly stated that they're going to, you know, do all they can in their power to eliminate something. Well, if a person takes the time and effort to do that, then I would seriously question his or her desire to help improve the program. I think there are vehicles for improvement within each of our organizations. And you are using some of those in the society. Some cages were rattled maybe by yourselves and others, but I think it's been good.
Negotiations behind the scene, together with what turned out to be an illegal suspension of the society's membership, resulted in this announcement in 1972 by Tom Scanlon, the president of the student division.
Probably the most significant thing happened Friday when the society was served with a lawsuit. Our convention here, the entire organization, passed a resolution, passed it unanimously, to bring our grievances to the society, to get them to respond to it, whatever was necessary, including legal action. After the society amended its articles and bylaws to expel all of its members, to limit its membership to the board of directors, that we began talking to the Federation of Attorneys from Iowa.
While the conflict with the society was a major ongoing concern throughout the 70s, other activities continued. In 1972, we changed our name to the NFB of Minnesota. This change is first recognized at our state convention by Dr. Jernigan, president of our national organization and director of the Iowa Commission for the Blind, and we received a new charter of affiliation at the national convention in Chicago.
Since it's the first time I've had a chance to talk to you since the name of this organization became the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, I should congratulate you as the newest affiliate with that name and say to you that you should be prepared to be there in force in Chicago. It's one more reason why a lot of Minnesotans ought to be there, since you'll be receiving a charter at that time.
We have 19 states to give charters because they have changed their name to the National Federation of the Blind of, making more uniform and therefore more cohesive our movement. National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. President and fellow Federationists. As you can well imagine, an organization with 52 years of history such as ours, changing the name is quite a major undertaking. But let me say this, that we trust that we shall be proud for years and years to come, just as we are pleased and proud at this time to accept this charter of complete unification with the National Federation of the Blind. Thank you.
Our student division continued to be involved in other issues, as shown by a presentation in April 1972 by the Director of State Services for the Blind, C. Stanley Potter. A new employment section had been created there.
Last October, C. Stanley Potter, Director of State Services for the Blind, was our speaker, and we asked him to come back. He was willing. And I've asked him to talk about the placement practices and policies of state services.
Well, you know, whether you call the problems prejudice or misunderstanding, and I'm sure there's both, doesn't really make any difference. You got to deal with the problem of the reluctance to employ blind people.
Later that year, the student division met with the new superintendent of the Minnesota Braille and Sight Saving School, Vince Sfaldi. One question was whether the school would pursue accreditation by NAC.
Is the Braille School planning to seek accreditation from NAC?
It's one of the, I think it's seven goals I had for us this school year, was to sometime later in the school year begin talking about getting involved in the process to become accredited through NAC. I think any process that calls schools look at themselves, what you're doing, so forth, would be good, whether it's NAC or somebody else.
There are no standards in NAC that in any significant, meaningful way apply to the quality of services.
I'm not defending, you know, what NAC has done or hasn't done, because I really don't know. What you told me is the first I've heard of it.
The concern over the quality of rehabilitation services resulted in the consideration of whether we should provide such services, as discussed here by Mary Hartle and Joyce Hoffa.
We have talked some about introducing our own rehab program, which would include Braille. And I'm wondering if Mary feels that there is some possibility for us to do that, or if we should remain as we are.
We discussed this sort of thing out in New York. The idea of the NFB affiliates getting into the business of rehab, it's sort of a touchy thing because, in one respect, it's good to do it. I think we also should push the agencies and demand that they get into this and teach. This is the sort of thing we've got to do. It's a twofold thing, I think.
In the 1970s, it became more difficult to operate the home for the blind at full capacity. Fixed costs caused the home to operate at a deficit. President Archie Erickson outlines what would be needed to change that.
Regarding the deficit, I would propose two things, and you can see what can be done about it. I don't believe that we ought to try for a raise of any more than $25 in view of the tightening of all the welfare belts and everything. If we had five or six an additional residents here, we would have no real deficit, I do believe.
And here's a typical example of music played after a state banquet.
In 1973, Joyce Hoffa ran for the position of state president. At the time, all elections were conducted by mail-in ballots.
Here is Jenny Lean, the chairman of the election committee, and she's got big news for you all.
I surely have. As chairman of the ballot counting committee, it gives me great pleasure to submit the following results. For president, Ingwa Gunderson received 99 votes. Joyce Hoffa received 137 votes.
We'll call on the winning
President Joyce Hoffa so that I can present her with the gavel that will help keep order as it has for the past about 43 years, I believe this thing is, old. So, Joyce, if you'll step over here and...
Oh, thank you. Well, I...
I knew you'd stutter.
What did you say a while ago? I don't know whether I was more nervous before or after, or I am more nervous now. It's hard to tell. But I do want to thank you all for your support, of course, and I hope that you won't be sorry in a few months that you've taken this stand. And I can promise you one thing. We're all going to work hard. I certainly am. The members of the board will. And we're going to make sure that all of you do, too. I want to urge all of you to participate fully in the activities of this organization in the future and inform yourselves through the bulletin and through attendance at meetings, contact with other members of the organization on vital issues so that we can carry our message throughout the whole community, the state, and the nation, so that everyone will know that we're the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota.